You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
We're going to trounce Meatloaf and we're going to fucking try and take Years and Years down. And it was grotesque the way we did it in a lot of ways.
Hello and welcome to Midnight Chat, a podcast of casual interviews with leading musicians, published weekly at midnight to suit these informal and often under-researched conversations. This week's episode is hosted by me, Stuart Stubbs, editor of Loud and Quiet magazine. On tonight's episode of the podcast, I'm joined by James Smith, the singer of Leeds-based band Yard Act, who, in January of this year, 2022, went toe-to-toe in a chart battle for number one against Years and Years. Spoiler alert, they didn't quite do it, but they charted at number two. And with James on this episode, I'm going to get into the margins and just how close the race was. The debut album that was challenging for that top spot is called The Overload. And if you haven't listened to it yet, what are you playing at? You should not only check out the record, but I would recommend starting with their videos. It's something that we also talk about on this podcast. They're all extremely well put together, very funny, and for me are what Yard Act are all about. It's a good symbol of where this band's at and how they're approaching things. They're certainly having a laugh with it, which perhaps comes down to the members of the band all being in various indie bands over the years, including Hookworms, Menace Beach, and in James's case, a band called Postwar Glamour Girls. All great bands in their own right, but Yard Act seems to be the one that has connected with people. They are, at the time of recording this, the most booked band of the summer. They're playing almost every festival you can imagine, so maybe one that you're heading to yourself, so there's plenty of opportunity to see them. I have to give a special thanks on this episode to the Bedford Tavern, the pub in Finsbury Park. They opened their doors early for James and I to go and sit in their empty pub to record this episode. So thank you to the people at the Bedford Tavern. This was recorded back in April, this conversation. The band had just returned from America, where they'd been for the very first time, and they'd been storming South by Southwest literally a few days before we spoke, and that also just played the Jimmy Fallon show, which is where we will pick up the conversation. If you do enjoy this episode and are interested in helping us make some more episodes of the podcast, then there's a link in the show notes to supporting us with a donation of your choosing. It can be any amount, big or small. It's very much appreciated. It helps us carry on making this podcast. We've had a long break between the last series and this new one that starts tonight, ultimately because we've been trying to work out how to afford it, essentially. So any help from our listeners is very much appreciated. Thank you very much to James. He was a pleasure to talk to, and I'm very pleased to see a band like Yard Act signing to a major record label and putting that money to some good use and having a good time. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the podcast, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. First up, here is James Smith of Yard Act on Midnight Chats. You've just been to America.
Yeah.
It looked good on your Instagram feed. I was following South by Southwest stuff, and you did Fallon.
Yeah,
Fallon.
We did.
Fallon. How was that?
Great.
Are they recording that show with a live audience again now?
Yeah. So we got to go into 30 Rock and do that. I think they're still doing sessions from home. I think Wolf Alice with a guest the night before, but they just sent in like a pre-record. But like to be able to go in the studio was wicked, and you know, felt like quite proper.
So who were the guests on the show when you were there?
Ethan Hawke.
Okay. Yeah. Was it just him?
Just him and a comedian called Jim Jefferies, who I wasn't. And I'm not really aware of, but
no, I'm not.
He's Australian.
Right.
It's a shame because they've only just gone back in. COVID was pretty, the rules were pretty strict. So there was kind of no mingling. Like, I basically spent the day walking past Questlove's door and it was just locked. And
just trying to just hoping just you would time it when he just was coming out.
And he'd be like, hey, come on in. Don't worry about the rules. I'm Questlove. I can do what I want. And then about, I think they start taping at like 4:30, 5:00. At about sort of just gone 4, his door was just ajar as I went to the toilet. And I was like, Questlove's in there. But
you couldn't get him?
You couldn't really. I mean, I would have knocked on, but you know, it wasn't the vibe. But Fallon came to see us before and after we played. And I didn't dare look up. But when we, because like, so where we are on the stage, if you're facing out, the audience is directly in front of you, but there's like a sea of cameras in front of the audience. So they can't really watch what you're doing, which is weird.
Right, okay.
But then to the right is where Fallon sits with his desk and his interview sofa. And to the left is where the Roots house band is.
Yeah.
And like, I did not dare look up and see what the Roots were doing. But Ryan says he raised his head and Tarek and Questlove were just like nodding their heads to the overload. So I'll take that. Yeah. I'll take Ryan's word for it.
Were you not tempted to just eyeball the Roots? Go the opposite way?
Yeah.
Sing directly at them?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it's...
Stare them down.
Most people I would, but it's the Roots, man.
To be fair. That's pretty...
They were a big band for me growing up, you know.
Were you...
Getting the tipping point and just being like, fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you nervous doing it?
It was all right, but it's the most nervous I've ever been. I think the gravitas of the situation, I was aware of that. And for the most part with this band, I haven't been that bothered, which I think has worked in our favour. Like, genuinely, like, I've been quite comfortable with whatever. And then even when we did, like, when you do big things and you're like, this could really do something good for us, and it'd be really handy if it did, like Jules Holland and stuff. Yeah. Well, with Jules Holland, it was like, it wasn't live. We were shooting it at the Bruno, which we know that room inside out. You know, the crew were dead chilled out. We had all day to do it. And there was no audience. So it didn't feel like... The pressure wasn't the same. We knew we had to get it right. We knew that it was going on Jules Holland, and it was really important to us that we delivered something we were really proud of. But Fallon, it was like...
One take, right?
Yeah, but they go, you can have a second if you want, but if you do need to redo it, everyone's going to cheer, the Roots are going to play you out, and then just don't leave the stage, and then we'll just do a second take and Jimmy will introduce you again. And it's like, can you imagine? Like, he was like, yeah, whatever you need, like, you can do three if you really need to. And it's like, but like, you know, we went out, we did it. It was like, we were kind of sat waiting all day. And then we went out and Jimmy Fallon and Questlove are kind of bantering with the audience off camera to keep them sort of entertained whilst the camera's set up. And then the production runner's like, or like, you know, like the director's like, okay, we're ready to shoot Yard Act now. So then Jimmy goes back to his desk and the lights go down.
Holds up the record.
And he does his holds up the record.
Making their US Best TV debut performing the title track to their debut album, The Overload. Give it up for Yard Act.
And then it's like, you see the red light go on and it's like, all right, now we do it. And so we just blasted through it. And then all of a sudden, Jimmy Fallon like runs over and he's like jumping up and down, shaking your hands, going, yes, yes, yes. And then the Roots all of a sudden kick in and he's like, good night. And then it's like, and then it stops and it's like, okay, do we need to go again? Imagine if you said, yeah, like after they've done the big ending and it's a fake ending. The second time would be really depressing.
Yeah, it's not so an even option.
Unless you'd absolutely cocked it up massively. Definitely wouldn't have gone again.
It looked good. I've watched it and it looked good. It looked like, you know, I'm guessing you were happy with it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You were
yeah,
like, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
What's Fallon like?
I mean, I guess we met him pre and post show. He's hyped up.
He's like, pumped. He's, yeah, yeah. I mean, apparently, I've heard he's always like that. I was listening to a podcast recently. I can't remember what it was on, but someone was saying how he is that guy. Like,
yeah,
it's not an act. He is that guy. 24/7.
I mean, it seemed as sincere as as it could have been within the few minutes we spent with him.
Yeah.
And we met one of his managers, and they were basically just like, he's a massive, massive fan of music. Mm. Like, he has a big hand in choosing the acts, and he's genuinely invested in the music on the show, and he loves bands. Like, you know, that's his thing. Like, I know he's, you know, I mean, he gets great guests on his show, you know, Act included, obviously.
Exactly.
And so it's nice to know that it's not like a segment that it's like, oh, we put this in for a bit of variety and he's kind of just falsifying it. Like, you know, and we were kind of watching from the in our dressing room, they like show you the TV, and he was like hyping it up. Like, he must do that for every act. I'm not a regular watcher of the show. I can't get access to it easy, but it felt great, like having him like making an audience get whipped up for what you're doing. It's nice. It's a nice thing.
I remember, God, how many years ago would this have been? Maybe, I'm going to say eight. It might not be eight. Could be any time. But I remember when Eagles went
On Letterman.
On Letterman.
That was a big moment.
It was
for
a
Leeds.
Big moment.
We
it was
very
like
proud.
It
yeah,
was
yeah.
like, holy shit. It was like, it was really cool. It was, and
yeah, yeah.
You know, you're like, oh my God, that's Eagles. Like, on Letterman.
Yeah, yeah.
That's mad.
Massive.
Do you know? Do you know those guys from?
Yeah, yeah. I know Goldie and Tom Kelly pretty well. I ain't seen them since before the pandemic. I saw Tom Kelly and he works in a bar in Leeds called Wax Bar. I saw him in there not long ago. And we're mates with different members of them and know them from around about. And
I remember that moment and being like, and it happens every now and then when someone like, you know, a British band that you know or have followed or that are local to you go and do something huge in the States. And you're like, it's just such a moment and kind of like Yard Act on Fallon felt a bit like, that's what it reminded me of. Maybe it was because of the Leeds connection as well, but just from what you were doing. Yeah.
From a Leeds perspective, when Eagles were on it, it really did feel like that. There was, you know, the hometown pride comes out of nowhere and it was just like, God, that's massive. That's like, that's not just like, oh, this band's doing pretty good. Like, it's good. Oh, it's good to see they're doing well. It was like, that's amazing. And then there was like pictures of Tom with his Bill Murray tattoo next to Bill Murray. And it was like, I mean, it's when it's just like, when it's like just normal people and the underdogs, isn't it? It's not the kind of, I think I've put ourselves in the same category, you know, like it's not the kind of band you expect to see on American telly.
Yeah.
And you root for that, you root for that. And and it's a shame Eagles kind of just disappeared because
they were a great band.
Yeah.
How have you found like the Americans taking to like the British nature of you guys and the music? I mean, firstly, like when you did the Fallon thing, were you tracking or were you told about the reaction like at the time?
I don't know. I don't really check. I mean, we had
it's
a
probably
lot of,
best not
yeah,
to check.
No, I definitely wouldn't Google. I wouldn't like to Twitter search our name and find out what the general population.
Have you ever done
America.
That? Have you ever?
I used to do it. Yeah. And as we started to get more popular, I stopped doing it because
it's a
once you start
place,
getting popular, that's when people start to hate you. Yeah, and you start to read stuff about yourself, and it's like, Jesus, this person said they want to deck my lights out, and it's like I'm rubbing someone up the wrong way enough for them to say that on Twitter. It puts you on that slight scary thing. It's like I'm aware that people are aware of me that I'm, not
and they know who you
of.
Are. Yeah, yeah.
And they actively have an impression of me that they're seething enough on the internet to say something violent about. Mm. And like,
although I'd say that most Twitter's so heightened, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. I don't actually.
You
feel
probably
in
haven't
danger,
done.
But.
Much at all. No, you haven't done much to get them there, you know.
But I think on general, you're in the impression of people on the internet, whether it's typed or whether it's a clip or whatever, you get like a you, and if you see that pushed in your face over and over again, as I know that Yardats has been, if you're not into it, I'm aware that I could be the most irritating, frustrating face mug on your fucking timeline over and over again, and I'm sorry for that, but it's the way it is.
Like, it is right now.
Yeah. But yeah, so I don't do that now, and I don't really even read nice comments that are underneath our own posts. Like, I get alerts for them, and I'm kind of not that I'm not grateful for them, but it is. Well, to be honest, I wouldn't have any time in the day, Stu.
You're a busy man. You're a busy man now.
No, and it is. I don't need my ego massaging. And if I did, I'd start reading the negative stuff as well to keep me in check. But I think I can probably keep myself in check just by not looking at it at all.
Yeah. Do you have a... Because this sort of thing is my idea of hell. Because I'm really thin-skinned.
Right.
And... It would only take one bad... It wouldn't matter how many good ones there are. It's only it's only the bad one that you remember. Are you quite a thick-skinned guy, even though you don't want to read this stuff?
Well, like, your monkey brain instantly reacts out of anger and upset. Like, that... And that lasts as long as... That's like a primitive trigger. If someone says anything negative about you, you don't go, yeah, that's true. Like, you go, what? But then I do think I'm quite good at rationalizing after that. I mainly put myself in the situation where I've had those same thoughts and feelings on other bands. Yeah. Not that I go on the internet and say it, but I probably did when I was younger. Like when, you know, the Wild West of Facebook in my early 20s, I probably had a million opinions on bands that I thought were shit or this is the best thing you'll ever hear. And like, you kind of get past that and you get more comfortable, and so I accept that for everyone's opinion on it and the superlatives they use and you know, positive or negative to describe how they think about us, that is heightened and it just passes anyway. So you kind of learn to cope with it. I mean, yeah, it's fine. Everyone has an opinion on music, and it's just what it is, isn't it?
Looking for some fun? Let Scratchers lead the way. Countless ways to scratch. Come join the play. Instead of keys, what can you find? Think of something fun. Leave the coins behind. Grab your guitar. Hold the pick tight. Scratch as you strum. Let the rhythm ignite. With your drumsticks, riff a solo so great. Or place your scratchers on the turntable. Scratch and rotate. So get creative and find new playful ways to scratch. Scratchers from the California Lottery. A little play can make your day. Please play responsibly. Must be 18 years or older to purchase, play, or claim.
Ready to disrupt your industry without disrupting your flow? The Levy Evening MBA program at Santa Clara University might just be the perfect fit. The Levy School of Business is where you'll reach new heights without compromising your current career. You'll meet your part-time MBA cohort 2 evenings per week on Levy's campus in the very heart of Silicon Valley, where innovation and creativity thrive. Join Silicon Valley's premier part-time MBA program for working professionals. Search Levy Evening MBA to discover more. One more time, Levy Evening MBA.
When I was on my way here, I thought, where are we going to start this? Where shall we start talking? Because a lot's happened. Yeah. The other big thing, I guess, was the number one race.
Yeah.
Which, that looked really fun.
Yeah, it was.
Was it really fun or was it really stressful?
I think it was stressful for Pete, our one-man crew. He had to get to like four places in a day.
Is that your tour manager?
He was, but now
he's dead.
We've expanded. Yeah, he's 6 feet under. No, he's like he's his first role is as sound engineer.
Right.
But in the first sort of 6 months to a year of playing live, he was also driver and tour manager because that was what the budget allowed.
Of course, yeah,
but now we've expanded and we now have our friend Jilly as tour manager and sharing the driving. And then, you know, hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have a third crew member because it's happening fast. And, you know, and it's also ace to be able to give our mates work.
Yeah. Like,
that's the... We've kept it in the family so far, and that's important to us, and it's working, and that's nice, and it keeps us grounded having those people around as well, I guess.
It was a proper...
It's nice to take a weight off Pete, I guess.
Poor Pete.
Yeah, poor Pete.
It was a proper campaign you did. Like, you went for it. It was great. It was, impressive. It was like, yeah, we're gonna go for this.
Yeah.
And it was narrow. How narrow was it at the end?
In the end, it was like 2,000 sales in the end. Okay.
But that's not many, right? Or is it? I don't even know.
I mean, I guess in the grand scheme of things, it's not. But I mean, so we did 17,500 sales in the end in the first week, which compared to what things used to shift is a pittance. And you know, we're completely aware that it's all smoke and mirrors. Like,
yeah, of course.
Nothing changes after it, really. I mean, it shifts perception, and that's the main reason we did it. And it would have shifted perception a lot more had it been a number one, I think. But we're aware that it doesn't really matter. And, no, you know, sales are never going to be eye-popping like they used to be.
No. Even,
and, like, people try and do it with streams now, and it's like, well, that's had a billion streams, and it's like, yeah, but it's not a billion people have actively listened to that song, is it? It's like giant playlists in gyms and stuff. Like,
yeah.
But you know when it's kind of become part of like a cultural conversation or not. And I think that week, for that week at least, I think it was like we just stared the music industry head on and went, look, we're on a major label. We've never been in this position before. We're not going to be cooler than thou and just go, oh, whatever. We don't care if we land at number six. We're going to trounce Meatloaf and we're going to fucking try and take years and years down. And it was grotesque the way we did it in a lot of ways. But it was also like, why not see if something happens?
Yeah.
Because it's...
You didn't get any kickback on that though, did you?
Not really, no. No, I don't. No, we didn't at all.
Because I feel like we've kind of got to a point. I mean, I'm just talking about my own opinion as I've got older, but I feel like indie fans, quote unquote, have now got to a point where, because those numbers aren't what they used to be, everyone's on their ass. And it's hard. Like everything like in music is hard.
Yeah.
That now people are like, you know, if Uggs are going to give you £1,000 to say you like their shoes or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I feel like we've all got to a point where like, that's fine. If that gets my band to make a new record that I love, then it's fine, you know? And with your campaign, it was just, it was great to see you just go for it. Were you remotely disappointed that it was two and not one?
For about 5 minutes when we found out.
Right.
Because we were on that high of like, the whole week was so exhausting. And then we got blasted at the Brudenell on Thursday night after the last show, and you know, our booking agent was there, Ollie, our manager, was there. And
do you find out at midnight?
No, you find out at like 9 in the morning,
right?
But some of the boys had stayed up all night waiting to find out. I'd gone to bed and I met them at the Weatherspoons. I got a phone call at 9:30 saying, you've come in at number two. And I was like, oh, well, that's all right. Like, you know, after like, I was like, oh. And I was like, oh, that's fine. I was like, where are you? We're like, we're at the Weatherspoons. We've got some champagne in. Come down. So, and it wasn't, it was Prosecco.
Of course it was, yeah, Weatherspoons.
That was Ireland's marketing manager. We've got champagne for you at the Weatherspoons. And it was Prosecco. I was like, would it have been champagne if we were number one? He was like, of course it fucking would. And he was like, yeah, he was funny. Like, he was brilliant. And we just totally, we just loved the whole thing of it, really. And then we all went out for a really nice pub lunch and sort of decompressed on a week. And that's when we really reflected on what it was really about. And it's like, oh shit, we all just, everyone just went hell for leather on something that we really believed in. And sort of, whilst knowing as well that it was totally like this strange position to be in, but we took advantage of the chance and kind of ran with it. And yeah, we're just completely honest about our intentions with it. And it was like, we booked about fucking 10 in-stores in trying to shift more records, and now I've got to fucking go and do them all, which is like but they're all in good places. We're doing them in like Warrington, where I grew up, and Derby, where Ryan comes from, so like, you know, they're good, like good meaningful shows, but it's made May look like absolute chaos. But it was worth it, and I don't regret any of it. And you know, it was exhausting. We did 21 shows in 7 days.
I mean,
and not sorry, 21 in stores. I think we did 16 shows, five of them were just signings. But like, it was relentless, and we were running on like, we were running on empty, and it was like, it stops. We just knew that it stopped as soon as the chart week ended. We were like, then we'll rest. And it was fun. I had fun doing it.
When you like finished the record, whenever that was, last year, I presume.
Last March.
And you had it ready.
Yeah.
Did you have any kind of goal or expectation of like, this record, obviously, you know, we're going to put this record out. Had you signed at that point?
No.
So you hadn't signed. So when you, on the strength of just the music and the type of music it was and the way it sounded, did you have any thought of it being in the charts at all? Let alone getting to that point of a number one.
No,
race.
Not at all. But once it, because basically off the strength of how well the EP had sold, we were kind of told like,
you've got a chance.
This album will go top 40, which for us was like, what? We'll have like an album in the top 40. And that's because you need to sell like 2,000 records to get in the top 40 or whatever. Mm. That's all you need to do now. Week one, right. Sales is 2,000. And the other thing that is often overlooked is that week one is not all your sales sold in 1 week. It's your pre-orders from when you start campaigning 3 months before.
Sure.
So it's a bit of a, again, like I said, it's smoke and mirrors. Yeah. And I don't mind admitting that, because you've got to face the truth head on, haven't you?
Yeah.
But also go along for the ride and have fun with it. And yeah, we were kind of told, you know, like based off the sort of buzz you've kind of got and how well this is sold, like you should get a top 40 with your debut album. And that was like, at the time we were going to self-release it. But we were talking to quite a few labels, but nothing felt right. And even like the big indies that we were speaking to, we were kind of like, they want this much to do that. We were like, no, like we don't, you know, it was like, I love this label. This is my favorite, one of my favorite labels of all time, but I can't give them that much for what they want to take and give us, you know. That's when loads of major kind of labels got in touch, and we were like, none of these work. This is all weird. But then Island kept coming back and they totally got what we were about. And it was like, we knew it was like a completely different sort of world to what we were used to. But we're so used to the indie world that we kind of know its limitations, because it does have limitations. And we were kind of like, if they're going to put this money in, then I don't know. We were just at a point where we're like, shall we just see what happens if we let a major label go with it?
Yeah. And I guess there's probably part of like, because you'd all been in bands,
yeah,
and you'd all been on indies, and it's also like, well, why not just try something different, right? Like
that was like, exactly it.
Let's just try a different thing, and if that doesn't work, it doesn't work, and that's fine.
That was it. It's like, what's the worst that happened? It's like you'll get dropped after one album, and then you're going to do what you did anyway. Mm. And it was like, cool,
sure,
let's try it then. And it seems to have paid off so far. But the other thing is that people always think that like, people put so much on the future and the longevity of stuff, but that's also not the most important thing. Like, bands don't have to exist forever. And I think we just knew that we would do music. We'd all hit that point in our lives where we knew that we were never going to stop making music. I've said this in so many interviews, but it's just because it's true. Like, I will write songs and release them to no one, and I will play gigs to empty rooms. I won't tour to empty rooms because that would be boring, but I'll still go out and play shows to a handful of people when all this ends, because I just love it. And I do. And I love bands. I've realized that as much as I love music and songwriting, I love bands. I still love the romance of a band. And they seem to be making a comeback at the moment. And I think, I don't know, maybe after the pandemic and people being isolated so much, they want that camaraderie of a band again. They want to see people together and see themselves within that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
I think that's a really good thing that comes with getting a bit older, as someone who's older now.
Yeah.
Is like, you know, when you're younger and you see, like, say you see a band that had that moment, and now they went to the top, and now they're back down and they're playing in your local pub to a few people. When you're a kid, when you're like a teenager and you see that, you go, oh, this is so sad. Isn't it so depressing for them?
Yeah, yeah.
But you can't really see that they want to be there. They're not doing it because they've just got to that point where they're like, this is what I do. And I used to do it to lots of more people than I do now. And that's fine. Like, it's completely fine.
That exact thing happened with a younger friend of mine when we were watching a show in Leeds, where someone who, they are in a legendary band, and their side project sort of plays to 20 or 30 people. And me and Ryan and our friend were watching him, and like, we were like, oh, it's fucking so good seeing these old dudes just rock out. Like, they just love it. You know, they were great. They were so good. Yeah. And they just, like, there was probably a bit of disheartenment that they were playing to 30 people, but they were just playing their songs, and it's like, they've never given up. I think me and Ryan saw ourselves in that band that night. And it was like, we use the term lifers. Like, we're like, they're lifers. And I remember when Ryan first said to me, you're a lifer. And I was like, and he was like, we've seen, like, you're not going to give up. Like, this is basically him and a couple of other people that are in bands in Leeds, like, pulled apart by horses and that. Like, Ryan was in Menace Beach. They were like, you know, you've just kept going and you're not going to stop. I was like, no, I love it. And it was like, you're a lifer. You're not like moaning that there's 10 people at the show. Because we've all been in bands with people who do that. And they drag you down when you're like, well, why are you here? You know, like, what did you expect? And a lot of people are entitled and expect stuff. But maybe our friend anyway, she was like, this is so depressing. And I was like, it's not. They're amazing. Look at them go. And she was like, but no one's here. I was like, yeah, if a legendary band plays to 30 people, but the other 27,970 aren't around to hear them play, did it happen at all? Like, you know what I mean? It's like that. It's like, no, this is what it's really about. Yeah. All the other stuff comes and goes, as exciting as it is.
Yeah,
like, don't deny you don't want it and you don't love it, but it gets beyond that. Yeah, so that, and I was like, and I think I said something like really patronizing to her, like, oh, when you get older, you'll understand, like, because it's like, nah, it's, these guys know what they're doing.
What was your first band then, your very first band?
My first band was Postwar Glamour.
It was,
Girls.
Right, it was. Yeah, yeah. I didn't know if there was one before
No,
that.
I played in like sort of covers bands and that as a teenager. I had a band back in Warrington called City Lights, with a couple of friends from school. But, you know, that was kind of, you know, a lot of covers and small time. Yeah. Small town, small time. No, it was good. It was really important for me, that band. And it,
well, because Postwar Glamour Girls did well for a first band, for essentially your first band.
Yes, I started that in Leeds. When I came to Leeds, I went to the College of Music, and that band City Lights actually ended because I was the drummer in that band, and our singer Joe passed away, and that hit me so hard that I kind of said I was never going to do a band again, which is a dramatic thing that an 18-year-old will say. And I was just going to go to uni and, you know, make beats. It's going to be a beat maker. And yeah, and then I slowly found the rest of the members of post-war Glamour Girls, Alice, James and Ben. And yeah, that went on for a long time. But that was completely, you know, pretty much completely ignored by the industry. And we just couldn't really, we did some really big things considering we couldn't get a break, you know, like.
Not was it, really was it three things. Records you made?
Yeah, we did four in 4 years. Four. Well, because we did a live album, but the live album had new songs on it. And we rewrote it as a six piece. We did a lot on a shoestring, but I was always obsessed with moving on. We never really let anything sort of gestate, and I could never also wait for responses from emails. I was always like, this person clearly hates us, let's just do it on our own. And right. You know, like looking back, I was a 21 year old managing a band of 21 year olds with no understanding of the music industry. He was, because he was a pretentious 21 year old, was obsessed with I just want to make my art, and I don't want to be a part of this industry that has no interest in me. And what it really was that, like, people get 1,000 emails a day, and if they don't reply to me in 2 days, it doesn't mean that you can't send a follow-up. You know, it means that. So yeah, so that was a weird, yeah, it was a weird time, but I just feel like I learned so much in that band about myself, and I grew up in that band basically. And I was so angry in my early 20s just at the state of the world, which now seems like a place I'd love to go back to.
Like and, with the good times.
Yeah. And just, you know, kind of stuff that was going on in my personal life as well. And I didn't think about it at the time. And I just wanted to channel it into music, and that's all I ever wanted to do. And as I grew up, I kind of couldn't maintain that anger that I had, that I used to have. I was like, this is subsiding. And I felt like I couldn't deliver it anymore. And I started feeling like I was doing an impression of my younger self,
right?
And I don't think I had the sort of self-belief or the guts to be me yet. And so that band kind of came to an end because everyone was kind of moving away and stuff, and we'd given it as long as everyone else was willing to give it before they were ready to do other things, you know. So then I did this band Cruel World, which I was like, We just couldn't catch a break, but like musically, I was just so into it. And that was like really sort of like songwritery. I kind of went the opposite, so far the other way. I was so sort of ashamed of my own voice that I kind of tried to neutralize it as much as I could.
Do you mean like the sound of your voice?
Yeah, sound, like I've never liked the sound of my own voice. Like, I don't think many people do.
Oh yeah, mine's awful. And
yours is nice though, like I've enjoyed
it's
it.
It's like a goose.
No, it's not.
So you know, but you know, when you listen back to your voice,
yeah,
mine just sounds like a kind of monotone honking goose. That's how I describe it.
Right. Well, I find it quite comforting. Oh, I'm going to listen back and see it. Yeah, see if it sounds. Obviously, everyone sounds deeper in their own head.
That's true. That's Yeah.
You've got a lovely voice.
Thank
too.
You.
I just want to clarify that before I moved on.
I'll just be clipping that bit and
just leave
make
it.
That into a sting.
Yeah. Maybe you could send me that for my beats folder and I'll make you a beat. I just was like, but I was also convinced that the way that I delivered those songs and the aggression and the anger in my voice on those records was like the reason that we hadn't had the success that I wanted. And so I started neutralizing everything. And I think it culminated in like some songwriting that I'm really, really proud of, but I sucked my own, I like deliberately edited my own personality out of these songs because I didn't have the sort of guts to be myself again at this point. And like post-war felt like it was a really extreme version of myself that I then couldn't get to grips with changing. And so I stayed stuck in this sort of impression of angry me, which was kind of, I'd learned to cope with my anger in a different way. And then Cruel World kind of became me going, hey, I'm so mellow and relaxed now. Which, like, Most of the time I am. Sorry. Most of the time I am, but I was so relaxed. I just... like, most of the time I am, but it's not. I'm not one thing or another. And I think Yard Act, by the time that came around, as it started to do well, I started to have the confidence to be completely comfortable with who I am and accept that I do have these bursts of anger and frustration. But for the most part, I am on this level which we're at now. And I think that's kind of how we approach everything we do. The performance is kind of in me being me.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Is nice.
So
that's
now when nice. You hear yourself back, whether it's like on a recording like this or singing,
yeah,
are you at peace with it?
Yeah, because I've just realized it doesn't matter anyway. Like, yeah. I'm like I don't know at what point it happened, but I basically think once we got an audience that we realized was sticking with us for the time being, at least I felt I was like they just like me doing what I do, and so I don't need to study myself or worry about that. I don't need to worry about the people. I'm not conscious of what the people who don't like it think anymore.
Yeah.
And I think it's what, I don't know, like, I'm not being smug about it, but I think it's what everyone's trying to achieve in their own life, is to be comfortable in our own skin. And I feel like I finally, as close as I'm going to, have got there for the time being.
And you're really young to have got there. You're like 31.
30, yeah, 32 this year.
32.
Yeah.
That's good going, I think. If you've sussed it.
Yeah.
I mean, it might not last, James.
No, I don't. Well, I've had a good run. I've had a good run in life over the last few years. After quite a turbulent, you know, late teens, early 20s, I feel like everything's kind of come up James for a little bit. And I'm not taking it for granted that there will be turbulence ahead, because no one gets that easy run, you know.
Can we quickly talk about your videos?
Yeah, of course,
because I'm a big fan of all of them.
Yeah,
particularly the magic one.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
That,
yeah.
I mean, I'm going to put a link to all of them in the description of this podcast, yeah, because they're all worth a watch. One question I've got is, who are the people in them? Because there seems to be like some recurring actors in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's the guy with the braces, the bald headed guy?
Oh, yeah, Gareth.
It's Gareth.
Yeah.
I appreciate. Are these people you know? Are these people that you cast once and then thought we'll just get you back for like other ones?
Most of them are people that the production crew know, like family and friends, and a couple of castings. Some are like street castings. So like Kaylee, who is the dancing orphan with the lettuces, she appears in Payday and The Overload. Me and James Slater, who directs the videos, we went to Leeds Bradford Airport car boot to do a recce,
right,
to see if it'd be a good location.
Was it shot there?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there was two castings from the car boot. One was, Kaylee's mum was just running a stall there, and Kaylee was just like dancing next to the car, just entertaining herself. And James and Jack and Rosie are the producers. They were just like, she'd be great for the video. Let's go and ask if she wants to do it next Sunday. Like, let's get that dancing in the video. So she was just a punter at the car boot dancing. And she was like, yeah, we'd love to do it. And she came back. And then the one-eyed king, him and his partner live in their camper van, and they visit the car boot to sell their wares every now and then. And we were like, would you be up for wearing an eye patch and a crown and being in this? And he was like, yeah, of course.
Of course I will.
They're like, mate, you know, I follow them on Instagram now. They live the hashtag van life, and they just travel the country with their dog, having van meetups and that. And so it's nice to stay in touch with them.
So who's Gareth? Who is Gareth?
Gareth is Jack's stepdad, and he's just the loveliest man. I can't remember what he does now. I think he's, I don't know. I can't remember what he does. He's great. He's just great. He just came along, and then he's just like, I don't think he'd even heard of us before the first song. And he's been in three of the videos, and he's like, he is a big fan now. Like, he drops his messages and that. Yeah, it's great. There's loads of wicked people in them videos.
Have they, I think, like, you do some pretty good acting in them.
Right, yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, it's Land of the Blind, isn't it, with the magician one?
Yeah, yeah.
Where you're sporting a goatee.
Yeah, yeah.
It suits you. So
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Slick back
it's
hair.
It's a bit of David Brent with the slick back hair, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really David Brent. Yeah. So that's that bit where you make the 50 pence disappear and you crawl out the room.
Yeah.
I'm going to make me and this 50 pence piece disappear.
And that
was improvised.
That me. I loved that.
Yeah, yeah. That wasn't meant to happen.
That's brilliant. But the there are parts in there are bits in all of them where you like have you ever did you act at school?
Yeah, I was in the plays and that. Yeah. I used to who did I play? I did the Artful Dodger and Oliver.
I can see that.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have to do a Cockney accent for that?
Yeah, of course. It's dead easy. I won't do it now. But I I'm trying to think what else I did. Yeah, I did theatre studies at A-level as well. Basically, there wasn't enough subjects that I would have been allowed to do if I hadn't have done like all the pretend subjects. So I did theatre studies, media studies, English language and music tech. That was me big four. And I always loved it. And then I kind of went off it because of some of the other people who do it that take it so seriously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I did it as well.
And did you?
I know the exact
Did you continue it? Did you pursue it?
I pursued it. When I went to uni,
yeah.
I did film and drama.
Like amazing. Split cool. degree. Yeah, yeah.
But I knew as soon as I got there to day one of the drama side of it that, oh, hang on.
Yeah.
I'm out of my league here.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know when you're in school, you can be. It's quite easy to be the best in your school.
Yeah, yeah. Were you the best in your school?
Well,
sounds like that's what you just said.
Well, I'm gonna lean into that and say yeah, but yeah, cool. there is a caveat. Yeah. By the end of my school, by my sixth form,
yeah,
there was three of us in the class.
All right, cool.
And one of them then got kicked out.
All right.
So we could only do two-man plays.
A lot of duologues, yeah, yeah.
And actually, if I'm honest...
Brecht's a duologue, right?
Yeah, that's what we did. Yeah, we did a lot of Brecht. And if I'm honest, now I'm thinking of it, I think I was probably the second best in the class.
Nah, you win.
But you know when you're like a bit younger than... Because by then I was 15, 16. When you're like... At my school, if you could remember the lines, you were the best.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't really need to actually put anything down.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you go to like university and you go, oh, and there are people there who are like theatre people who have really studied. And so I moved away from it.
Yeah.
I completed the degree, but I moved away from it.
But
I know exactly what you mean. Actors can be the worst. Can't they?
Oh yeah.
And I mean not all of them. I don't want anyone thinking I'm down on all actors, but some actorly people, when they're being actors a lot of the time, it's a lot.
Yeah. But it all is forgiven when they do something amazing.
Yeah.
But they have to be in that frame of mind where they are already amazing when they've not proved anything.
Yeah.
Which I guess musicians do as well a lot. Well no, no, they don't. I don't know. Oh, it's a weird one. Yeah, basically there was just
they just weren't like, your people.
I'm going to do GCSE drama because I'm going to get to slide around on my knees in the school hall for a couple of years and fanny about with my mates. And then when it gets to A level and they all go, we're not doing drama now, we're doing like physics and maths and that. And you go, right, who am I left with? And, you know, some of my best friends. But it's the people that take it very seriously who can't act that really get me. Because like I never had, but also it's like it's the people that like it's like the great actors, like how do you have to be very resilient to do that in high school, the serious stuff. I just did pratted around and said we did comedy because it was like that was easy because that was just pratting around as far as we were concerned. Like, but for someone to deliver, for a 14-year-old pimply kid to do some brutal monologue about like the, you know, like the fucking like Irish famine, like it's playing like a 50-year-old like starving man. It doesn't work quite the same,
with
does
a
it?
Fake moustache.
Yeah. Like it's like you're gonna go for those deep, serious subjects, and you should be encouraging children. You should be encouraging children to do that at that age. Like you should be getting them to try and tap into something deeper about themselves, and to convey and deliver something that's so emotive it can make a teacher cry. But you're going to have a bunch of immature lads on the front row sniggering. Like, I wish that's not how the world worked. Maybe it'll change. But I mean, that's what it was like for me. But that's my own immaturity. You know what I mean? I was a late bloomer and it took me a long time to grow up. So I have nothing but respect for those people. I do. But that wasn't where I was at that time in my life, you know. And so I didn't really pursue it. I did do theatre studies and I did really enjoy it. And I wrote, me and some mates wrote like a musical about Summerfields, the supermarket. That's kind of our...
Perfect.
That's what was our end thing.
R.I.P. Summerfields. Summerfields is gone,
is it
right?
Gone now? Yeah.
Yeah, I think Co-op bought it.
We all used to work at the one in the village. So that was kind of, that was what it was written about. And there was like a turf war between that and the Co-op, which was quite, that was what it was about.
Well, history has proven Co-op won.
Co-op did win.
I think they bought out Summerfield.
Yeah.
I think that's why. Okay. I think that's why there's no Summerfield.
Maybe that's what the plan
is. It's ripe for a sequel.
Yeah. Co-op. Yeah. Summerfield Strikes Back. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So the, another thing I wanted to ask you just about the videos is, what is with the 50p, the recurring callback to 50 pence pieces?
So I guess we play on,
I should explain that this is something that recurs through these, through your videos.
It's in everything in the whole universe costs 50p.
Everything costs 50p.
Which is kind of a bit communist in a way, but that's not what... The 50p to me really symbolises, like, obviously the first album really kind of leans into nostalgia and, like, I wrote a lot of, because a lot of it was written during lockdown and I wasn't really sort of out and about experiencing things. I kind of delved into my own past quite a lot and sort of my own childhood and upbringing to kind of, you know, so it's got like a real sort of retro sort of slant to it, the album. You know, it kind of plays on that. It's set now, but it's also set in this like rosy past of an England gone by when things were simpler, because everyone loves to think everything was better in their day, even though. And 50p for me felt like the ultimate symbol of a lot of money, but worth fuck all. Like, like 50p is like, you know, I always think about the 50p mix. Because that was like one day, that was like birthday mix. It was like, you got a 50p? Or the kid with the 50p at school was swinging.
Yeah.
Like, you know, pound, that's like another league. You put that in your piggy bank, like you save it.
That's
that.
A banker, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But 50p was, it felt like a lot of money. It's also fuck all. So it kind of, to me, symbolises like our, it kind of symbolises our thirst for wealth and our view of it and how we sort of see it and what it is. And do you remember those like windy penny press machines that would like press like the logo of where you've been, like,
and it, you know, flattens it to an oval?
I wanted to do one of them on tour, that we could have a yard at one where you put your 50p in and you press it and it flattens your 50p and you get it back with a yard at logo on it. And there must be someone out there that can make that contraption. It's only cogs and a...
It must be.
A press, isn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, every seaside town will have that.
Yeah.
So there's somewhere that makes the stamp seaside town, right?
But I've never seen one with a 50p. Like, they might have to trigger... Like, they might have to reshape the chute.
But I think a 50p might be too thick.
That's what I mean. You're going to need some real strength to get that round.
You'd need someone with a big arm to be putting that through.
Yeah.
What's Pete's arm like?
Pete's arm. Well, it depends which his mixing hand is, because that's slightly bigger.
Because it could be a new job for Pete.
Pete does need more work. Maybe our next crew member will be someone with a big arm. Just one big arm. Arm. I did want to get one of them done, though. But again, this was, you know, like when I suggested it, like spitballed it. It was like, yeah, you could like, it could be like £1.50 to get your 50p pressed. And I was like, no, it'd be 50p. It's a freebie for anyone who's got 50p on them. I'm not trying to capitalize.
Yeah,
on this.
Yeah, it's got to be free.
Know, it's always got to be part of money, isn't it?
Mate, thank you for coming on the podcast.
It's a great way to end this.
I never know how to end these.
No, I think that's right.
Do you think we've missed anything?
No, I don't even know what we've talked about, but I have nothing to say.
Perfect. For previous episodes of Midnight Chat, simply search your podcast app and don't forget to follow or subscribe in order to receive new episodes as they're published every week at midnight. For more information on the music magazine that makes this series, visit loudandquiet.com.
Anyway, good night.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hey there, parents and teachers. Are you tired of feeling like every day is a battle of wills with your kids? Let me tell you about something that changed the game. Love and Logic. Love and Logic isn't just another parenting or teaching strategy. It's a mindset shift that empowers you to raise responsible, respectful kids while keeping your sanity intact. With Love and Logic, you'll learn practical techniques to set limits with empathy, give your kids the tools they need to make smart choices, and build relationships based on mutual respect and understanding. Love and Logic stands behind their methods with a one-year money-back guarantee. Try it out risk-free. If it doesn't change your life, we'll buy it back. Plus, you can get 10% off with code IHEART10. So if you're ready to say goodbye to power struggles and hello to peaceful, loving relationships with your kids, it's time to give Love and Logic a try. Visit their website or call today. Your sanity will thank you. Love and Logic, because parenting and teaching should be a joy, not a chore. Visit loveandlogic.com.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.